Hey there, and welcome to That Independent Streak. I'm your host, Wendy Campbell, and you, my dear, are in the right place. We created this channel as a place where we could all come together and have those conversations that it seems like we aren't having anymore, specifically related to those conversations around health, wellness, travel. Seems like after 40, a lot of things change. People stop talking to you about the things as if you no longer have an opinion. So we want to bring that opinion back. In fact, there's information that we have learned from our grandmothers and great-grandmothers that we should be passing on to the next generations, all the way down to our great-grandchildren, so that they can therefore pass it along. It's that spoken conversation, the spoken truth, that seems to be missing. So today we want to talk about something very near and dear to my heart. In fact, I reached out to today's guest almost in a plea of help, and well, it was necessary, let's just say that. I've been finding that as I get online, especially in this political season, that I need a little bit of guidance. Someone to sit down and kind of give me the rules for how I can present myself on social media. It seems like they've got the crazy people over here, the super crazy people over here, and somewhere in the middle is the rest of the population. So I wanted to talk to Lauren Hug, who is my guru of digital knowledge, of how to carry oneself in a poised and honest way online. So we brought her in today to talk about really those spaces and really the opportunity that is missed by a lot of people just abstaining from the social conversation altogether. In fact, did you know that women are more likely to remove themselves from the social conversation than men are? I'm not surprised, but are you more surprised to know that as AI goes through and creates the conversation and the language that's based on the social conversations, that AI is now filtering out the women's voices? It's kind of a scary place if you think about it, and therefore we should be more encouraged to get more involved in the conversation and speak our mind, because hopefully we're the voice of reason in theory, right? So without any further conversation on my part, I think it's important that we let Lauren speak her piece, because she is the master here. tell me, so like for those people who don't know your path and don't know exactly how digital kindness and digital hope all started, what made you kind of decide to go in that direction? What made you decide to take that on and try to champion a happier, kinder internet?
Oh man, it's it's, you know, we met each other during Waldo Canyon Fire, I believe, the very first time online. Right. And that was the first time I really saw that people can come together quickly, really quickly, to do stuff that like even institutions couldn't do, right? Mm-hmm. That humans together can accomplish something without being directed to do so or without anybody in charge. And so that was really exciting to me. And it also showed me that people actually are nicer than we think that they are. Like we've all been taught that we're selfish, this whole narrative that human beings are very selfish and they're self-interested, and that we really have to have all these controls in place to make sure that we don't go murder everybody. And that's not what we're actually like as humans, most of us. And so it was just a really great way to be able to see that people can do these things really kindly in online spaces. But then beyond that, there were just so much people using it more like in political speaking or marketing speaking, like reducing themselves, complex, interesting, idiosyncratic, weird human beings to like one tiny piece of who they are that really you would never see in an in-person setting most of the time, because it's just a very small subset of who they are as a complete human. And I think it's because of the way the platforms are designed and the kind of prompts the platforms give us, and also what we see everybody else doing, right? Like we are natural mimics. And so when we see something being done a certain way, that tends to be the way that we do it too. So I just wanted to show that there was a totally different way to be expressive on these platforms that show more of who we are as humans and help us see each other so that we can work together to solve the problems that we are all facing, because we got some big ones.
Right. Absolutely.
and we're not going to be able to solve it unless we figure out how to work together.
Do you think that, and we're going to go to heavy quick, but do you think that the advent of social media and things like Twitter, where people are in, you know, 120 characters and boom, 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 do you think that that has hindered our process as Americans to find real democracy? Because one, we've got bots that we're contending with. Two, you've got like 10% of the population that actually participates and is the loudest, and it's misrepresentative of the mid base where, you know, every moderate in the world just cringes, I'm sure. And nobody's really saying the right things, but I noticed that things are getting passed and laws are getting pushed that aren't necessarily the will of the people, but it's the loudest people that are screaming really, really loud everywhere that seem to be pushing an agenda and a narrative that doesn't necessarily align. I'm curious what you think.
I don't think that social media, it gets blamed for all that, but I don't think that it created that at all. And I don't really think it's a huge contributing factor either. I think that we've had those people have always been around, and the squeaky wheel has always been an issue. Anybody who does any kind of public process knows that you're going to get overrepresentation of people that are way more upset about something than you're ever going to get other people that are like, hey, things are pretty darn good and really appreciate what you're doing.
Right.
That's not how, just before social media, that's how people have always been. And so I think that it gets the blame for a lot of what's happening, because the people that are the most irresponsible about how they use it and who don't care are using it to do really horrific things, in my opinion. But I think it's because the people that do care take a little bit longer to catch up to how technology is working and how to use it and to find their place in these spaces. And that's a lot of what my work is to say, this does impact how decisions are made, what kinds of things get introduced, what kinds of things get passed. And we all have, I genuinely believe this now, we all have a responsibility at this point to be present in these places, because we do represent so many more people than the voices that are out there. And when we have that kind of nuanced, comprehensive, complex look at things, it's a lot harder to reduce it to these very simplistic and oftentimes idiotic solutions that don't actually work and wouldn't make any sense if you just had three other people in the room with a different perspective. You could very quickly figure out why that's not going to work. So I think that that's the problem, is not the formats so much, but the fact that so many of us have opted out of participating here. And a lot of times it's people, when I talk to people, when I speak, it's, oh, you know, I just don't like those spaces. Cool. Well, I don't always like voting either.
I know. It is kind of a hassle, but I'm going to do it anyway. But yeah,
there's a lot of things that I don't necessarily want to do, that I don't want to shovel my sidewalk on the mornings when I'm running late because I have a really long sidewalk. But I also live in a neighborhood with a lot of elderly people. So, you know, there are certain things we do as citizens, as humans, that matter. I think this is one of those things.
I think that's fair. I think, you know, to this day, you are my little Giuseppe or whatever, the little cricket, Jiminy Cricket on my shoulder whenever I'm online, especially on Twitter. There is that voice where I'm like, okay, delete, 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 you know, and it's like, it's a matter of, I have so much to say, but I don't even know if I'm arguing with a bot. So this urge to like get it out and speak it out, because I am an opinionated person, and I, like a lot of people are, and I'm not afraid to share my opinion. It's just my nature, and I apologize in advance. But I think that, you know, to your point, the requirement of getting out there, there is a lot of energy that's exerted in that. And so that protection of your space and protection of your mindset, I think is really important. But one, I want to thank you for being my little cricket. And two, you know what I realized? I actually realized this today, and I've taken this opportunity to, I'd say probably in the last, since the real heavy political cycle started, right? Mm-hmm. If I go on Twitter, I have a time limit. So I'll only give myself about 10, 15 minutes, and then I'm like, jump. But I realized that I'll automatically go to Pinterest. And it's, yes, and here's why. I was like, well, maybe because there's not like the back and forth and you don't really know. It occurred to me, I go and I look at food, because food is a comfort place. So I go to de-stress while looking at food. I don't know what that says about me. But I think that rolls back to, how do we find a balance and a space? If the goal is to participate and the goal is to engage, then how do we, and this obviously rolls into your planner too, but how do we take control of that space to protect ourselves and also engage in a way that isn't harmful emotionally or mentally or even, you know, to our relationships? A lot of relationships were ruined through COVID, and I don't think that's changed. I think it's still that vigorous, I guess, discourse.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that everything I do, I say it starts with how your own well-being, right? Because we're all so different. And some people love debate and argumentation, and other people want nothing to do with it. And some people have no problem logging off after 5 minutes, and other people, like, they get on and 3 hours later they're like, what happened to my day? And so there's, I think, one of the most important things we can talk about with any kind of digital space conversation is we are all individuals. It's like with nutrition, right? Like, I get deathly ill if I eat raw broccoli, but like, it's super healthy for you and you're supposed to eat it. It just doesn't work with my system, but I also can't not eat any kind of green vegetable. And so we all have these different systems in the way that we process. So starting with what works for you. And what makes you feel safe, what makes you feel like in control so that you're not dealing with, I mean, there are, these things are designed to be addictive. There are things you can do to make them not addictive. You can turn notifications off and whatever, but like, I should say this, the platforms are not designed for human thriving. Like, that outside, the current platforms that most of us are using, that we think of when we think of social media, have absolutely not been designed for civic discourse and for healthy, flourishing relationships. Like, they're not at all designed that way. Yet we can still use them, and they are still being places. They are still places where conversations are happening. So important conversations are happening. So, with that said, figuring out whatever is going to work for you about approaching these spaces, and both my books, Digital Kindness and Digital Grace, include a chapter on self-care. And you mentioned, thinking about it, typing it out, deleting it. So I've only recently become interested in gender differences and how we use social media. And I'm speaking next month on International Women's Day, or for International Women's Day. And the statistics on women self-censoring in digital spaces are astronomical. So, like, 9 out of 10 women, like, self-censor, self-restrict how they show up in online spaces because they're afraid. And they've seen 85 or 86% of women have witnessed other women being attacked online for something they said. And so it's interesting to me that, like, a lot of my advice in my earlier books has been reinforcing that notion of let's think twice. The problem with that is, right, if women are more likely to do that anyway, and here's somebody like me is saying, hey, let's consider what we're saying, that means that our voices, women voices, are far underrepresented in these spaces. And
Did
that
you
means,
just give me permission to go back in? Because I have no problem with the pushback. That's not my problem at all.
you should consider it, because when you look at it from that perspective of being very underrepresented, right? So that if the vast majority of things that we are hearing, perspectives that we are receiving, and perspectives that are being put out there are male, I mean, that's. And then you add, like, that's been true of almost the entire Western canon has been made, like added up through history. So everything that our phones know, that AI is now scrolling through to create its own generated content, is very skewed towards male perspective, male experience, male words, male ideas. And so that's just been really interesting to me to think about, that I've known for a long time that people who don't think twice, who don't rewrite, who don't worry about how they're going to be perceived, already are at an advantage. I mean, as far as like churning out content, right? Being a voice for all the people that are being thoughtful, it takes 3 hours to write something versus 2 seconds. Now, if you look at it through a gender lens, it's like, oh, wow. Okay. So already the thoughtful people aren't present, and also the women aren't present. Now, what does that mean? Who are the most likely voices you're hearing
Oh,
on?
excellent. That's a scary thought. I mean, it really is concerning. I think one of the reasons that I hesitate, and I'm just going to use myself as the example because we're here, but one of the reasons that I hesitate is because it's twofold. One, I've got a lot of female friends who may not align, and I don't want to offend them because I love them. But two, it seems like there's like this collection, like you're not only like if it's one thing to have a back and forth. It's another to have a back and forth with 400 people who don't know you and suddenly now are going to tell you what you think. It's exhausting. So, I mean, it's how would you coach to, I mean, and I think it's upon all of us to take a little responsibility, but how do you coach to, you know, women getting in there and speaking, but also to women and men and keeping the balance of conversation and civility? Like, civility is lost. And so I think maybe we should look at that too.
Yeah, I think civility is such an interesting concept, right? I can't remember. I think it was an author called Nasreen Malik. I hope I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Don't know that I've ever heard it spoken. She wrote a book called We Need New Stories. And the American version subtitle is The Myths That Subvert Freedom. And she has a chapter on the myth of free speech. And she talks about how essentially debate can only happen when both participants or all participants are safe mm-hmm. and their humanity isn't being questioned. And so when we talk about civility, for a very long time, only a few people were allowed to have any kinds of debates because everybody else was excluded from debate. They weren't allowed to be there. They weren't allowed to have an opinion. They weren't allowed to vote. They didn't own property. There's a whole bunch of things. And so the more voices that we have now that are part of conversation, and the more that we're debating whether or not these voices belong, whether they count, whether they're valid, like, so there's two issues with civility. It's like, I think we have to set the terms, first of all, of what are we even talking about? Because if you start trying to debate my lived experience, that's not a debate anymore. Now that's an attack. Uh-huh. And so it's very hard to have conversations about stuff that is deeply personal and like directly impacts how a person is living their life on one side, and in no way changes how right. another person is going about their day at all. And that, I think that if we start recognizing that, we might be able to see how some of this stuff has become problematic because it's not the same field. We're not talking about the same thing, and we're not dealing with the same experiences.
Which is also interesting too, because over the last 10, 15 years, there's been a change in communication in the offensive level, right? So not necessarily you've said something so offensive that we should all ban you and move forward. Now the line of what I'm going to be offended by has been pushed forward so far that it's difficult to have a conversation without someone throwing down a offended card. I'm offended. You need to stop talking. You need to silence your opinion because it offends me as a human. That to me is a really disruptive way to set up conversation and communication within a civil group. And I don't know where in our social contract we all agreed to that, but it seems like it's being misused in a general sense as far as manipulating the conversation and not allowing for open conversation.
Yeah, and I think that one of the easiest guidelines to follow is this. If you're offended about something that isn't affecting your life, sorry, you're not actually offended.
I'm with you.
That somebody has a difference of opinion that it does impact their life and that you don't have a lived experience that in any way informs this conversation. That happens a lot. Where the people attempting to silence through the offensive references are people that this does not actually impact. And it's real, really easy to tell if something impacts you or not. Like that is a pretty simple litmus test. If it is in no way going to change what you do tomorrow morning, it doesn't impact you.
Right.
And you can have your opinion. Everybody's entitled to their opinion, sure, but your opinion is very different than the person whose entire life changes tomorrow based on your opinion. Like, and I think that when we get down to some simplicity of that, like that this isn't about like political correctness. This is like, does this actually have anything to do with you at all? And if so, explain how. And most of the time when you really get down to that, people can't, because it's just a thing that they think for whatever reason, and they're welcome to think it, but it doesn't change how they go about anything they do on a daily basis.
Right.
I wish that we could all start thinking that way. It's really,
I mean, I think with the interest of inclusivity, right? We want to include everybody. Sometimes people feel they need a safe space and we want them to feel strong. And so I think we overcorrected into that realm. And I do believe that, you know, again, it goes back to civility. We should be civil to each other. We should, you know, I don't care what a lot of people, like, I don't really care what everybody's doing with their life. Like, as long as it doesn't affect me, I really don't care. But I do have opinions about things when they're for the entire for the entire group, when they're more broad-based, I do feel like we should be talking more about that kind of thing, because it really is. I actually wonder, have you thought about using any of your tools and gifts to coach political people, to like people running for office, people in office, governments in general, because that's where a lot of the dark is.
Yeah. I mean, well, it doesn't actually benefit any, most of them.
No.
There's nothing to gain from being a reasonable human. I mean, no, that's not true. There is. If you look at the most recent city council, I mean, not city council, mayor election in Colorado Springs, an independent mm-hmm. black man, mm-hmm. immigrant mm-hmm. was elected. And anybody who knows Colorado Springs would say that that was not possible, right? Specifically that you couldn't run as a not as a Republican. Like this right. tends to be a Republican stronghold. And so even that, like not choosing to run as an unaffiliated candidate runs against like conventional wisdom of mm-hmm. how you run campaigns, right? So most people, I mean, so it does work. It's just that that's a newer story.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It is an unusual story so far. I think mm-hmm. we're going to start seeing a lot more and more of those. But anybody who's got ties to traditional parties, anybody who has ties to traditional campaign strategy, mm-hmm. that's not going to be,
yeah.
not going to gain much by being the reason.
Unfortunate. Yeah, no, it's really unfortunate. I think it's true, but it's really unfortunate because there's a lot of gross. But
it's interesting when you look at the rise of unaffiliated, like, so specifically, I haven't looked at the statistics for the whole state, but in El Paso County, there are now more unaffiliated registered voters than there are Democrats and Republicans combined. And so it will be interesting to see with upcoming election cycles, how people play partisan politics when the majority of the voters don't align with either party.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly what's going to happen, but it'll be interesting to see if there are some different choices made looking at that demographic statement.
I think it's true because a lot of people are not feeling connected, right? So they're not feeling like they're being heard. Their issues aren't being resolved. They're probably online like the rest of us looking at this back and forth and are exhausted by it. You can't really go to mainstream media because, again, you're getting a whole lot of opinion and not a lot of reality. And so there's this uncomfortable place of something has to change in a big, bad, ugly way. And if it means that we abandon both parties and we go in a different path, then so be it. So if that's what it is and that's what saves the country and democracy as we know it, then so be it.
And I think it's that the simplicity of binary choices, whatever those are, like mm-hmm. that's never been real. nobody has ever fit into two boxes of any kind. Pick the boxes, right? Like even if you're talking vanilla and chocolate ice cream, there are times when you want to swirl. Like, we're just not that rigid when you really get down to how humans are. But our systems have forced us into choices. I say this all the time about politics. If your choices are yes or no on a ballot initiative, like, so if you're 51% yes, you're voting for it. And if I'm 49% no, I'm voting against it. And we look like we're this.
Mm-hmm.
Really, we're right here. It was just that we had to pull the lever for something and we pulled it the way that we leaned. And it in no way represents the entire overlap between us where we would have been able to find some sort of consensus had it been worded differently, had we been part of the conversation, right?
Right. Well, and they are written so that they're almost indescribable and unattainable as information bits, because the way they're written is just to pass the law or not pass the law, depending on which party writes the law. But it's really unfortunate because it should be a government for the people. It should be the people have an opportunity to say and understand what they're voting for. But again, they should also be educated in a way that is conducive to that without any sort of filter.
Right. And I mean, I can't remember. I hate when I can't think of who said something because I prefer to give credit to people who think things. But there's some writer that was talking about, like, what if we wrote legislation in poetry instead of in legalese? And what kind of people would we be if that's what it looked like instead of the way that it is? Because I say this as a non-practicing lawyer, like legalese, it's just a whole nother language. It's not human speak at all. It's a very specialized category of language that only a handful of people know how to read. It's archaic, but we still do most of our political process through that kind of alienating
Right.
speech.
Right. It's unfortunate. It's unfortunate. You know, even I look at children today and as they come up and their frustration with the way that we've created the world for them. You know, they're kind of like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. And here we are, and you all bought into it. Why did you buy into it? And I think we all bought into it because it looked different 20 years ago. It looked so different 20 years ago.
Well, and we didn't know anything else.
Sure.
I mean, everything seems normal until you realize it's not normal. I mean, so many of us grew up in toxic environments, learning all sorts of unhealthy behaviors from the people who loved us. I'm not even talking about people that didn't. I mean, that's a whole nother thing, but from like the people who truly loved us and who wanted what was best for us.
Right.
We're following things that we now know are absolutely destructive to small human beings, to large human beings, to so like we you do the best you can until you learn better, but then you're stuck with these systems that have been around for forever. And those are hard to move very, like they're hard to move even over long periods of time, but in a short period of time, forget it. And
Yeah.
I wanted, like, I was thinking of this, I'm pulling this out of my book bag. You'll like this. This is written by John Alexander, and it's called Citizens, why the key to fixing everything is all of us. And
I like
it's
that.
very much aimed at like, how can we collectively and collaboratively come together to solve the problems that we all have, and things like citizens assemblies, where you're talking about a much truer version of democracy, of random selection of multiple people. So you're getting people from all over. Now, I mean, there's always problems with selection processes because depending on who you decide doesn't count or gets to restrict, right? Like, I mean, think about jury selection. In theory, it's everybody, but it's actually not, because there are these people that get exceptions, and it's understandable why, because you can't just give up your whole life if you're caring for somebody who needs your round
Sure.
of care or whatever. But like,
sure.
That means that those people are never on juries, because we haven't made it possible for them to serve in a space. So anyway, self-selecting mechanisms aside, the idea that when you really do pull a whole bunch of people from different walks of life to come together, to have conversations, to make decisions that affect all of us, you're going to get better decisions, and you're going to get a lot more fair and more reasonable decisions. And I've said this for years as a trial attorney. I don't understand most of the time how juries reach the decision, because I used to do mock juries and would watch the deliberations from behind the two-way mirror. And it was always wrong, like as far as legal reasoning. Their reasons were like all over the map, but they would almost always come up with what's, in my opinion, was a just outcome. And I think it's because when you put a bunch of people together, like barring something where one person dominates, or, you know, there are things that can change the dynamics.
Right.
But it's hard to come up with a really bad decision with a bunch of people with a lot of different perspectives.
I agree. I think I will. I mean, I think that we've lost the art of social engagement in such a way that we stay in our little groups, and our little tribe is our little tribe, and we only talk to this tribe because that tribe's crazy, and that tribe, they're very violent and we don't like them. And so, you know, it's like a safety mechanism. The world has gotten bigger, and so we've gotten more small.
Both are happening. It's an and. Some people are getting smaller and a lot of people are getting bigger. And so there's both are happening at the same time. And when the people that are expanding and stepping outside of their boxes and their tribes and their whatever, and going, oh my gosh, see all these things that we have in common, that brushes up against the people that are getting smaller and smaller and more closed in. And so that's where a lot of tension is coming from too, is that, I mean, one of the reasons why I'm such a big fan of social media is that it is a place where you can see, witness, experience, learn from all sorts of different perspectives that you're never going to encounter in your physical environment ever.
Sure.
And that, I mean, if you're willing to look at it with curiosity, I mean, for me at least, it's hard to see all these things happening and listen to all these different voices and not be changed somewhat in what I think about the world. And for me, I mean, I've dramatically changed based on all of these things that I've seen, people I've met, stories I've heard, things I had no idea about because it had just crossed my path before. And then it's funny how it does start to cross your path. Once you start to see it, you start to realize it's always been there. And I didn't have to see it before because nobody I loved fell into that category, or it didn't impact my daily life yet. And so, yeah, I mean, it's one of the things I like about the accessibility movements is any change that helps any one of us helps all of us. Curb cutouts help all of us. It helps people on bikes, not just people in wheelchairs. It helps people that have mobility problems, like that are, that's harder to step over a curb. You know, like it's actually, most of the stuff is not hard. It is that we have been indoctrinated into systems that say that it is, and that we can't do that. And it's like, well, why?
Right. Well, but I mean, to that, I think a lot of situations that we butt up against, you know, there's the logic isn't shared, right? So in a lot of situations, decisions are made, they're not communicated well, or they're communicated to pander to one side or the other. Look at what I've done for you. Look at what we did against them. We are so against them. Where I think, you know, if there were, I don't know, some sort of independent party who legitimately wanted to share the information in a way that was just pure information. The problem is everything's bought and paid for now. And so you've got corporations running things, you've got individual, billionaires investing in information. And so it's really hard to break it down into the smaller, digestible information that it should be.
And we all have confirmation bias. So even
we all
when,
do.
even when it is as neutral as possible and as objective as possible, our confirmation bias will step in at some point, and we naturally fight against something that doesn't fit what we know to be true about the world. Like, that's just,
it's a survival mechanism. I mean, it goes back to caveman days, right? So it's what we know, and we're gonna, you know, keep ourselves alive by making that decision. I mean, it sounds really grandiose, you know, much like I'm not gonna die if I'm on Twitter for 15 minutes, but it's hardwired, so it's hard to break out of.
Yeah. Well, and everything that we do makes sense in some context. It's just that it doesn't, like, I mean, that's like basic therapy. Not that I'm a therapist, please don't. Like, anyway. But all of our coping mechanisms saved us in some situation. It worked at some point in time, and that's why we did it and why we continue to do it. And so we have to learn when it no longer works, or how to create new responses, or to recognize that this is a different situation or something. People, I mean, I think that it's very important for people to realize, no matter how much somebody's doing something that makes no sense to you, it makes sense to them. And they're like, until you can understand why it makes sense to them, sitting there going, you know, that doesn't make any sense, doesn't work. You need to actually ask and understand, like, so wait, why does this make sense to you? Where are you coming from? What are the experiences that you've had that make this make sense? Because from my perspective, I don't understand it at all. My daughter, she's so great. Like, I love Gen Z. I could talk all day long about how much I love Gen Z. I was looking at some product. I don't know. It had come through my social media feed. I was like, what is this? I don't understand why anybody would need this. And she just casually says, well, Mom, if you don't understand what it's for, it's not for you. I was like,
well, she is a woman of the world. I like her.
It wasn't like condescending or mean, but she was just, it was like, it,
yeah.
She didn't even have to process that. Like, that's just how she sees the world, because she's growing up in a world with global access and all sorts of different perspectives that I never had growing up. And she cares a lot about accessibility and inclusion. And so, of course, like, a product that's designed to allow somebody to be included is not a product I need. If I don't need to be included in that way. So it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. No,
right.
No.
But my, makes me wonder about your algorithm a little bit, but yeah. Yeah. I mean,
my instinct was like, this is so dumb. Why does this, who made that? Why would that? So I have this judgy little, like, this is so unnecessary, and never once thought about who it could possibly be meant for and how it could help people. I was like,
yeah, but let's not forget that little sassy side of you is also a lot of fun. And so we need to learn to laugh a little bit more too. Like, sometimes you get that ad so that you can laugh at the situation, because everybody's forgotten how to do that. And I just think it's important.
Well, I think that's another thing, like comedy, you have to understand the scenario to understand the joke, right? And so again, I mean, so I was having this conversation with a friend of mine, and I don't have any answers to this. I'm really, maybe we talked about this before, I don't know. I'm very curious about, can we have content that means something to one group of people and doesn't mean anything or is bad for another group of people without it being like dangerous, right? And I think about, there's this TV show called Atypical. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
I think so.
The premise is that it's an autistic young adult and his family. And there are things about that show that resonate with me as a mother of an autistic young adult, right? But I have no idea if that would resonate, that experience would resonate with my son, and the way that that individual is depicted would resonate with my kid, because it isn't written by a person who is in that group of people, is written by this other group of people. And I don't have an answer to that, because there are definitely things that are going to resonate with me because of my lived experience that in no way will make sense to somebody without my lived experience, and might even be offensive or even problematic or like bad. And so I'm like, I don't know. That's so when you talk about laughing, like I struggle with that. Like I can see things that are definitely harmful to people that I care about, and that also strike me as funny in the moment. And I don't know what to do with that.
Right. Well, no, I agree. I mean, I have an off-center type of sense of humor. So I'm going to laugh at things. Usually I laugh at things that are targeted at me, because for whatever reason, laughing at myself is fun and I'm self-deprecating and whatever. But I do see that there are a lot of, like, there are things that I don't get. And I, to your point, I just don't finish watching, or I, you know, I'm like, I don't really, you know, I saw a comedian, you know, a few months ago, and I was just kind of like,
Yeah,
wasn't my thing, but you know, I laughed a couple times, but at the end of you know, the comedy night, I didn't go and boycott the comedy center. I didn't go and boycott the comedian. It wasn't it. It was just kind of like, eh. And then you move on and let it go. Like, I can't even tell you half the jokes now, because it just kind of didn't stick. It just, none of it did. But so many people seem so offended, and it does. I want people to feel comfortable. Like, in my perfect world, everybody is okay, but everybody knows where their boundaries are and knows where their bubbles are and where they end. And, you know, you can get this close to me if you don't agree with my bubble, but if you, you know, I'll let you in a little bit further if you do. And there's got to be some self-regulation in there to manage some of that, because it does seem so amplified. Everything is so amplified right now.
Yeah. And I think what makes it hard, because I mean, I think about this a lot, like, where are the places in which I don't have power, and I'm the systems are actually hindering my ability to be fully part of this world, right? And they're not many, but there are some. So I think when you say you want everybody to be okay, everybody isn't okay.
No.
There are some people that are really not okay, and they are living like lives where they really don't know if they're going to be in danger in many situations.
Sure.
And so I think that that is it. Go that litmus test again of like, my ability to shrug something off has a lot to do with how safe I feel. And if I'm mostly safe, then I can shrug it off. But if I'm not, that's a lot harder.
And right. So, but in the context of humor, I mean, I'm not throwing jokes at people who are under life-threatening situations, you know, women who are in abusive situations. It's just not funny. That's not funny. That's not humor. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about broader spectrum things where we used to be able to laugh a little bit at ourselves. And now it seems like a joke can literally turn into banishment. Like, you can get canceled in a heartbeat for saying the wrong thing. And I don't know that I agree with that. I think that people should learn how to internalize, you know, but understand, look, it probably was targeted at you. It might have offended you, but do you need to carry it? No, you don't need to carry it. You know, that's different from, I am in harm's way and I need this message because this message changes my life.
Yeah, and I still think, though, that it depends on, like, making fun of yourself, sure. If it's a person that's part of a group making fun of that group, then cool. Nobody's going to have a problem with it. It's when it's people outside of the group make jokes at the expense of or about other groups that then people get offended. Because it's not, it's you know, it's like you can say bad stuff about your family, but nobody else better, right?
That's fair.
With that, I think that that's where we have to look at those lines is when is it making fun of myself versus when is it somebody making fun of me? who doesn't have to deal with any of the stuff that I'm dealing with and doesn't really understand what it's like to be me. So I think, I mean, and I think this is the conversation, I agree with you, these are the conversations we need to be having, because that's, at least then that is a conversation instead of a shutdown of like, sorry, I want to add about cancel. I don't believe in the cancel. I don't think it's a real thing.
I think it's a real thing. I think it can be immediately shut off by the person who's being canceled when the person who's being canceled ignores it. But there are a lot of attempts to get people canceled, and I don't think it's an invisible thing. I think it's real.
Well, I mean, I think there are attempts to get people canceled, sure, but what has actually happened to people who've gotten canceled, right? They end up with another show. They end up with a different microphone. They end up with more money and a book deal and whatever. I'm like, so there aren't...
All right, you might have a point on this one, yeah.
Like, I just... to me, this is one of those things where it's like, for every person that doesn't like you, somebody else is going to be like, you're my hero. So the cancel culture thing, I feel like, has been... It's much like the war on free speech. I'm like, neither of these things are real. They're made up, and they're made up by people that gain from making them up. And look at what they're gaining. They're gaining audiences, and they're gaining heroism, and they become these trophy or like posters for a movement. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy. Like, one of the easiest ways to get notoriety, a platform or an audience, is to quickly switch whatever you were before. And denounce all the things that came before, because now everybody's super happy on the other side to welcome you into their group. Like, and that's
ridiculous.
It doesn't move discourse forward at all. But so, yeah, I mean, I started tracking that years and years ago. Like, oh my gosh, this is so horrible. This woman, remember that woman that like tweeted something about something really offensive on her way to like South Africa? And by the time she landed, she was fired. And it was early. I can't remember her name. I'd have to Google it. But anyway, it was a huge deal at the time, because it was one of the very first times that, like, on a global scale, people were like, oh my, because she was on a plane and everything was blowing up, and she didn't have Wi-Fi. So there was no way for her to like cut it off, right? Like to delete the thing or whatever. So there were hours of this stuff happening. And it's all horrible. And I don't know how we would handle that today, because it was so early in all this stuff that nobody had been through it before, right? So I'm sure that was a horrible experience for her. And like probably a gross overreaction to, like, I think when she made the tweet, she only had like 150 followers. And by the time she landed, it was like, you know, tens of that. I don't even know.
I mean, good and bad, right? Suddenly you have a platform. It's crazy. I think, but to go back just one step and just to push back just a little bit, I think, you know what, there are plenty of people in the world who, like, I'm sure don't like me, right? Just as an example, right? Like, I say a lot of things, right? This is my skin. I'm pretty thick. But for whatever reason, they don't like me, right? I don't actually care about their opinion. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's cool. You don't like me. Darn, you know, so I think, you know, this need to put bubble wrap around people because they're offended or they're hurt or I've stepped on their sacred cow, you know, like, we're not friends. Like, do you know me? Like, if you know me and I've offended you, I'm probably not going to say the thing because I care about you. And I will probably self-monitor. And if I haven't, I will apologize. But if I'm online and I offend you and I don't know you and I don't care about you, who cares? Like, sorry, let's go on to the next thing. Like, you know what I mean? Like, maybe we're not friends. Like, I'm okay with not being everybody's friend. Like, that's okay, because I think we should be in a world where you have your thing and I have my thing and they don't have to be the same thing.
Well, I think you're talking now about normal humans, right? Like, people that have enormous platforms, if you're making money off of how many people are following you, well, then guess what? You get to deal with the fact that people don't want to follow you anymore or whatever. Normal people are a whole different situation, right? Like, because I agree with you. I think that people, there's no reason. I mean, so one of my friends the other day posted something. She normally doesn't say stuff like this. She said something and everything came out of the woodwork, right? Like, people that are just ridiculous. Like, clearly all they're doing is searching some keyword and deciding that they're just going to go after people. Block them all. And she was like, I don't think I've ever blocked anybody before on that platform. And I'm like, well, these people clearly don't pay attention to anything you ever say otherwise. and they're nobody that you know. So who cares? And she wasn't offended. It was just more like, oh my gosh, what did I? And then we go back to that, like that we somehow owe people a conversation that we do not know. We don't owe people anything. Like, mm-mm. Block them.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100% on that. I am always surprised when people get really down in it, and I just am like, if I've offended you, walk away. Like, I'm not going to chase you. I'm not going to go look for you and knock on your front door to complain about how you didn't respond or like my post. I don't care. So, I mean, I think people need to own a little bit of that too, and kind of take back control of their emotions in order to better represent what's really happening.
Well, and I like to think of it this way. Like, I like to analogize digital spaces to physical spaces, because then we know how to behave in physical spaces, right? If I'm over at your house, Wendy, in your home, I'm not going to start going, I can't believe you have that piece of art on your wall. Don't you know how offensive that is? I mean, like, I might think it, and I might not ever go over to your house again, but I'm probably not going to just start yelling at you in your own space. Mm. It makes no sense for me to do that, right? And so if we think about people's feeds, the things they put out on social media as their living rooms or their spaces, right? We don't go into other people's spaces and tell them how to decorate them or tell them why they're wrong about whatever they're doing there. So that I think that example, like people coming into somebody else's feed and being like, how dare you say this? It had nothing to do with you. I wasn't talking about you.
Who are you again?
Because you're right. Like maybe we don't want to be friends. You probably don't want to be friends with me if this bothers you so much and I think this thing. But I also did, but then there's a difference of like, now if I go into your house and I start telling you how I don't like everything you're doing over there, like, and I think that helps people think about this. So if you're scrolling and you see somebody say something that you don't like and you don't know that person, and
I mean, you can say something, but I just don't think there's any room to really, like, the back and forth is unnecessary, you know, like, if you don't agree, don't agree.
Well, and if you want to say something, I guess, cool, you can, but what are you trying to accomplish if you do?
Right.
Like, if I walked into my neighbor's house and started talking to him about, like, you should take down this, I don't know, this thing that's hanging on your wall or something.
Purple cow offends me. How dare you? Yeah. No, I get it.
What's wrong with you?
Yeah. Yeah. I have noticed personally, just noticed around conversations, you know, like not immediate friends, but like secondary. And I have noticed a lot of conversation that is more pointed and targeted as if it were like online. Not a lot, but I have noticed an overflow, and that's concerning. Like that needs to stand back. I've heard there was, like, it was a Super Bowl party. I've heard some things at the Super Bowl party where I was like, wow, that's an interesting thing to say out loud to a group of people you don't really know very well. But
yeah. Well, I mean, that's a personality trait that I've always sort of wondered about, right? Like, people that don't have a sense of who they're with, or that the thing that they think might not be a universally held opinion.
Right. Time and place.
I don't really know what to do with that, because that's just never, I'm not that way. I, for whatever reason, I've always sort of been able, for the most part, at least in my opinion, to tell. I'm sure there are plenty of times that I've said something that was totally ridiculous and sounded absolutely nuts to other people that were around me, because I didn't know where I was.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I admittedly stick my foot in my mouth few times a year. Like, it just happens, because it just does. But at the same time, there's a talent in reading a room, and I think there's a talent in reading your space and understanding your space too.
Yeah, I think that we do need some, I don't know, I mean, I also love people that are neurodivergent and just say whatever they think, because then like, you're not looking for hidden meanings. There aren't these weird you know, oh, you're supposed to know that thing, even though they said the exact opposite. You were supposed to know they meant this.
Right.
So I think it's kind of like, we live in a world now where we are aware of, or we should be,
right,
there are a lot of different humans out there. And whether, I mean, whatever metric you're using to talk about normalcy, right? Mm. I hate this word, but there's somebody that's not that. And we know that now. Like, we should have some awareness that whatever we think is the norm in any given space, there's going to be somebody in that space that is not that norm. And even if we think that they're the norm on these five things, there's a sixth thing over here that we didn't think about that they're not.
Right.
that we're so much more than any given, any one category. We're multiple categories. We might have very nuanced views on this thing, but very simplistic views on that thing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's, it does make it harder because we can't just be going on these like outdated rules of etiquette. Or, I mean, so I was in a conversation the other day about like somebody was talking about teaching professionalism to youth. And I was just sitting here thinking, what do you mean by that? What do you mean? What is professional? What is professional dress? For what field? In what space? For what gender? For, I mean, like, how, I mean, once upon a time, I could have told you what that meant. And I might be able to tell you what it means for a handful of professions because they still seem to adhere to some certain.
Sure.
Things. But, you know, 20 years ago, if you told me you were going to go into an interview with purple hair, I'd be like, you can't. And now, sure, go for it. You know, can't have visible tattoos. Says who? Says who? I mean, maybe if your boss, the person you're interviewing with, hates it, sure, fine. But, you know, like, so those are the kinds of things that become complicated as we have more and more voices in these spaces. And I read a book, it was a recommendation of a friend that was awesome. It's called The Art of Gathering. And one of the things, and this is a person who like does peace talks and stuff, like sets up those things, right? Like on a huge diplomacy level. And talking about how to create a space where people can converse. And one of the things she mentioned was all this, like this rise of like the pop-up events where they pop up for just like a day or two and they have very clear rules set out that everybody knows. And they're kind of, you know, kind of esoteric rules, like the white, the dinner en blanc, right? Like that's one of them. You have to wear white, you have to bring a picnic. It has to be like, what? I don't even know. I haven't gone. But like, in a way it's ridiculous, but in another way, everybody's coming at it from exactly the same knowledge of what's going to happen and what is expected from them. So that there's no class stuff happening where like, you just know that this is the way you hold your fork because you are raised holding your fork that way. Or you went to special classes to teach you how to hold that fork that way. And somebody who didn't have access to that doesn't know how to do it. Here, the rules are spelled out for everybody. So everybody, it's an even playing field for all people coming from lots of difference. Mm-hmm. And I love that idea because I think that's what we're dealing with right now. We are dealing with so much difference that we're looking for the threads that connect us and the things that used to, these things that we all said were like norms, actually weren't. They just happen to be the rules of our subculture, our society, right. Our group of people, whatever. And they're really weird to people over there. And so if we can start to recognize that that's what's happening, is that we're all making assumptions about what people should be doing or what is normal and how they're supposed to behave based solely on our experience of our little world over here. And if we're in somebody else's world or we have 17 different worlds represented, now who gets to decide which one's right?
Right. Well, I think it you know, we're at a fair point. I think, you know, 250 years in, it's a fair time to reevaluate our social agreement with each other. Really defining and learning how we can do this all differently because we are different. It has been a crazy, you know, little project, this American project, but I think, you know, maybe, but to your point, everybody needs to be heard. And I don't think that the people who are the majority of people are being heard. I think it's just the screamers, and the screamers are a problem right now.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I mean, to address that, I mean, one of my recommendations is just to put whatever you're interested in out into the world. Like anything that anybody puts out there dilutes the rest of the ick, right? Like whether it's puppies or whether it's the book you're reading or whether it's your I mean, it doesn't matter. It's just more of the human stuff that isn't all this other stuff. And it changes what people think they can put out there. And they might start seeing the fact that they can put their artwork out or, you know, whatever it is. And slowly that has impacts. It has ripple effects when we start being very different in how we use these spaces. And I also think that setting those boundaries on our own space, not just creating our own boundaries for ourselves, right? But saying on a post, hey, I'm interested in hearing from people who are like, so for me, I'm only interested in hearing from single moms right now because I need some help figuring this thing out for myself. And so signaling to other people, you're welcome to to listen in on this conversation because I'm having it in a public space. But just like if I was sitting at a table in a corner of a restaurant, you can hear what I'm saying, but you are not invited to be part of that conversation. You know that you're not invited to be part of that conversation because I'm sitting at a closed table with very specific people who are part of that conversation. And so I think that being able to say some stuff more like that is also helpful. And I've noticed that a lot with people, like trauma survivors will say stuff like that often. They'll say, I'm only talking to people who have had this same experience. And I think that's helpful because it then tells me, right, who doesn't have that experience, oh, I'm allowed to hear this, but I'm not allowed to opine. Because and then I don't have to feel rejected. I mean, to your point about getting offended, I guess I could get offended, or I could just be thankful that I'm not going to stick my foot in my mouth because somebody told me what the boundaries were for this conversation. And this is not a conversation I'm supposed to be part of. And I think a lot of what you're seeing when people are offended is that's happening. I think more and more people are saying, I wasn't talking to you. And I've now made it clear that I'm not talking to you. And you keep wanting to talk to me about this. And I'm
And I am walking the other direction.
not tolerating that. And I'm sorry that that bothers you, that you can't keep telling me what you want, but I've now hung up the phone. I've closed the door. I've uninvited you, right? And so I think that is happening a lot where more people are establishing boundaries, and that is bothering people who think that they should have unlimited access to people who decided that that's not how they're going to play this game. Because people didn't do that 10 years ago in digital spaces. I mean, I'm sure some people did. It just wasn't.
It was more
It
in the chat rooms
wasn't.
and So let's talk about the planner, because I'm curious. I was looking at some of the notes that you've posted, and I don't have the planner in front of me, and I'm sad that I don't, because
Look at me. I'm so prepared. Here
I
it
love it. I love it. Tell me like how it came together. I know you've been working in the space obviously for a few years with your books, but tell me how you decided to come to this and how it all came to be, because that it's lovely.
Oh, thank you. So when I first wrote Digital Kindness, one of my close friends who was a proofreader, she was like, I want a journal for this. Like I wrote a lot of notes in my margins and I just wanted a different way of absorbing it. That was 5 years ago. And so it was in the back of my mind for a long time, but that I'm personally not somebody who tends to use these more like guided journals. I'm very much a free flow journaler type person. And
Same.
so I couldn't quite figure out a way to do it that made sense to me because that's not how my brain works. And I happened to see one of my daughter had some sort of journal that was like, oh, as soon as I saw it, I was like, I get it now. Now I know what I would do with it. So it took me a while to figure out how to translate a lot of the questions that are in the original book into a journal format. And so I designed it both thinking that it can stand alone, like you could just go through it yourself and just think through, because not everybody wants to have my voice in their head when they're thinking about these
Too
things,
late for me, but go on.
right? I'm so thankful that you want me in your head when you're.
You just are.
There's things, I mean, I try really hard to write from a neutral perspective, but I have my own opinions and my own biases and all that stuff that it probably comes through in what I'm writing about the things that I care about. And that could turn somebody off. So how can I write it in a way that really is as neutral as possible so that anybody can come to whatever conclusions they're going to come to about this? And so the first 50, 100 pages is just prompts, right? Like just with space to write and just to think through these questions and figure out, this is one about like how you feel in digital spaces. Just to sort of think through about what you're doing, some of the questions that you're asking of like, okay, wait, do I want to set a time limit? Do I feel worse if it's 30 minutes, but not 15? Or, I mean, do I like this platform? I'm fine on this platform with all the food. It's great. But over here, I'm angry. Maybe I don't want to hang out in that space anymore. I mean, I don't go to places, I don't walk into places that make me feel angry on a daily basis. I try to avoid places that don't make me feel good. And I think we can do that with digital spaces. And then the second, like the next section is 30 days of just tracking your activity. I'll try to find that one. They all look the same. But so the questions are things like how I felt in digital spaces today, what I posted. Things that positive I saw, negative stuff that I saw, things I learned, kind thing I did, because it's kindness, and other reflections, and then time. So you can track your time if you want to, if that's the kind of person that you are. And then at the end of 30 days, there's a template for building your own digital kindness plan, right? So that's where those boundaries we're talking about come up. Do
Right.
Are there things I want to see? Or are there things I don't want to see? Are there things that I'm trying to learn, like perspectives I'm interested in that I would like to track? Are there ones that I just really am done with?
Right.
How do I, another one that I get, there's some questions in there about like, how do I share my own experiences online? You know, and what if my experiences involve other people? How do I want to talk about other people in my life when I'm talking about my life? Mm-hmm. Because there's no real way to do that. And then you're now bringing other people into your stories, which you can't really not, but at the same time, there's some responsibility that goes with that, mm-hmm. right? If we have,
especially with your children.
Absolutely. I have very strong opinions about that. And they're not necessarily the most popular opinions because I feel so strongly about protecting their privacy and their digital identity that to the point at which that it's hard for me to talk about my own experiences sometimes mm-hmm. because it does involve what's going on in their lives. So anyway, that's me, right? Like that's a decision I've made when I thought through how I'm going to do that. And I'm not saying it's the right decision and that everybody needs to follow it.
Sure. I'm just going to jump in really quick because this is one that I see all the time and it makes me just cringe. Please do not post pictures of your newborn baby with their name in full and their birth time and date. You've just opened them up for hacking for generations to come. So just please stop. Nice little nicknames are fine. Nicknames are fine. Maybe not naked baby pictures, but nicknames are fine.
The things that are going to haunt them later on in life. I mean, I actually just this that today is my audio newsletter is an excerpt from Digital Grace, and it's talking about forgetting in a digital age and how now you can't really get rid of stuff that has been posted because you have no idea where all the copies are and you don't know who else it's linked to. And it's a totally different process. If you know, if we have a bad breakup, we could burn all the stuff. It's gone.
Right.
It's like you're linked in 17 different people's photos because you went to some ski trip with them and it's going to pop up next year on March 6th.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, it's, yeah, that one's tricky. I think it's, you know, you have to be aware, like the world is out there and the world is watching and the world is not a nice place. I think we need to get over the kumbaya-ness of the world is happy and shiny because it just isn't.
I think it is more than we think it is. And also the bad person that wants to do the bad thing has way more access to information than they used to.
Mm-hmm. And also I apologize for whatever I said 10 years ago, because I was a completely different person 10 years ago and I had different opinions. I mean, like, I don't think we should hold people to even more than a year ago. Like I changed my mind all the time.
One of the biggest challenges I think is that we have not developed as a society a way of processing that, right? That people get, like when you talk about cancel, when people have to cancel, like stop running for office or get their college admissions revoked because of some dumb thing they said. Four years is an eternity for teenagers, right?
4 years, right. An eternity for me. I don't know about teenagers. Like, opinions change, things happen.
Yeah, we definitely like that. It's in my list. I have a list of a million things I want to write about. I have this peripheral research going on about what are we doing with forgetting in a digital age?
Mm-hmm.
And there's all, it's fascinating because we just have never had this. This has just never been a thing where all this, you can go back and find out everything that you said 10 years ago, even if you've deleted it, because it exists somewhere, somebody can go find it. And what does that mean? And can you change? And do we allow people to evolve? Do we allow growth? Are we going to constantly put people back to like, and then what does it do to our brains that we keep mm-hmm. remembering things like the whole moment, like that it pops up every year. Whereas prior to digital archives, if I wanted to remember a thing, I'd remember it because of a smell or because of a encounter. And then I would go look for the physical artifact that reminds me of it, like a yearbook or whatever. Right. But I wouldn't annually be reminded on this rando day.
Yeah, it's a little weird. It's a little weird. I think we could actually do an entire show on digital forgetting, but also on forgetting in general, in that you know, because we've moved to a digital space, so many people are now of the mind of, okay, well, this is where our history is. Let's erase everything that happened and not talk about it. And I'm afraid, and actually have considered getting a new series of Encyclopedia Britannicas just so that I have like the hard copy of what we talked about, because now everything changes. And because of the way that we are as a society, we're going to erase it. Not going to talk about it again. Didn't happen. Somebody got offended. So we're going to rewrite it. And now this is the new history that we take. And I get that that's happened throughout mm-hmm. time, but I think it's unfortunate that we're allowing it to happen.
I think that's interesting that I think they'll still exist as historical records. This is what we used to think.
I don't know if we're going to hold on to everything. Cause it seems like, you know, we're pulling down statues. We're changing the narrative, which is fine if the narrative is true, the new narrative is true. But how do we know if we weren't there what the real narrative is?
Well, it's Confederate statues, we do know what the narrative was because we had people who were there and then they made up a new narrative. And that's why this is what's happening, is that it's going back and realizing that the narrative that we were all taught was actually intentionally propagandized narrative.
I think all of our... This is a whole other podcast, because we could definitely go on we could go back and forth on this one, but.
And I think that's what's interesting about these spaces, is that those types of conversations are being had, and they wouldn't have been had without digital spaces being present, because the only way you can challenge a narrative is if you have an alternative narrative. Like, both have to exist for one to be challenged, because if only one exists, there's no challenge to it, right?
True. I think it's interesting. I think it's an evolving story that I think we'll have to keep an eye on and watch, because it is unfolding in real time. And so it's kind of interesting to watch. And also, again, I mean, I kind of want something solid that isn't in someone else's hands, so that when we retell the stories, our stories, you know, not all of them are hurtful stories. Some of them are true stories that we need to remember. So I don't know. I think we need both. I think we need a balance.
Yeah, I think that's where we're getting, personally. I mean, I think we're finally getting to a more balanced perspective, because we have more voices that weren't present or weren't allowed to speak at certain times. Mm-hmm. And I think I really do think that's where the tension comes from, is that when you've omitted entire stories, like, guess what? Now they're going to come in and you're going to be like, wait a minute, I don't know how to reconcile that story with the story that I was told. Because that story I was told was very different from, I vividly remember being in law school and for the first time ever hearing about Japanese internment camps and being like, wait, what? Like, we did what? Mm-hmm. America did what? Mm. And then seeing, not only did we do it, but the Supreme Court was like, and it was constitutional. Our constitution said it was totally cool that we did that. And I'm like, I don't know. I had no idea what to do with that, because it didn't fit anything that I'd been taught up until then. And it was very hard for me to reconcile that was part of my heritage, my history, my story, because mm-hmm. it didn't fit with the story I'd been told. Right? Mm-hmm. And that's challenging when we hear something that suddenly we now have to, how do we deal with both, right? How can both be true? So that's where, to your point, that we need to have conversations, because there has to be a place to process that, to be able to go, I never knew that. And now, and what does that say about me now? And who am I? And how right. do I handle this? And not
wait
just
till we get our heads wrapped around interdimensional beings. That's going to throw off everything. I can't wait.
I can't remember what his name is again. Somebody who worked for SETI. Right. And he's like, the reason he's so determined, he's an astrophysicist, and he's so interested in finding proof of extraterrestrial life. And he's like, because then humans will get their stuff together and figure out that they actually have more in common than they think they do. And I was like, that's such an interesting reason to care about that. Right.
I think it's true, though. I think at that point where we realize that this is all neighborhood warmongering, basically, like, Come on. We got big. This universe is ginormous. There is so much more out there. And to that, we don't even know what we don't know. So
I think that's the best motto, right? Like, we don't know. We know what we think we know.
We think we're really bright, but I don't know that we are. So
we find something else that changes the picture. And I think about those, what are those things where they zoom in on something? They have like the hyper zoom lens and you're like, what is that that I'm looking at? And you think it's a thing. And then they start zooming out and you're like, oh, it's a totally different thing. More information about this thing. I think a different thing about this thing. I think that's why it's hard to have solid stuff, is because we are always learning. We're always, there's something that we're going to discover that's going to change everything that we thought we knew. And I think that making room for that is what helps us stay flexible and not so entrenched in positions, is just to be like, oh, well, yeah, that thing is something I didn't expect. Differently
I
now
think
than
that's what
when.
makes it exciting. That's what makes life exciting. Like, if we know everything and we know exactly how things are going to go, there's no change in our day. Everything is on cue. We are in the Truman Show and everyone knows what everyone's lines are. You know, I think, God, that sounds like a fate worse than death. Like, I don't want to do that.
And I think, like, it is interesting to me that I think that the skill sets that we need for a world of difference, where we're always going to be discovering something that we didn't know before, is curiosity and humility, right? Like, those two, it used to be certainty. Like, leaders were certain, they projected confidence, they knew what they were talking about. And now I'm like, if you think you know what you're talking about, I'm pretty sure you don't know what you're talking about. Or you might know this one thing that you're talking about, but do you know how that thing you're talking about impacts that over there? Or have you even considered that yet? And so the more that we can recognize that there's all these things going on all the time, the web of interconnectivity and people and things, and I mean, every time I read science stuff now, I'm like, whoa. I was reading that said that there are human genes that don't express until after death. And I'm like,
What do you do with that? How do you know? Like, what kind of dead people are you
they
searching?
figured out, like, this thing does. I mean, I can't remember it because science is not my my brain is not a science brain, but it, like, there's something that it doesn't, they don't even turn on until the body dies. Like, that's when they start doing their thing, and it has to do with decomposition and some stuff.
You have to send me that because I'm very curious
It's
about
called
that.
Rooted. You'll love the book. It's really fascinating. I don't know if you'll like all the stuff in it or agree with it, but I was like, ooh, I don't, and I haven't done my research to go like
Man.
double.
Sometimes it's fun just to learn new things and wonder for a while if they're real. Like though your soul has a weight. That's fascinating to me. Did you
Really?
know when you die? Yeah, they've measured it. So when you die,
Wait.
you lose like, and I can't remember what the micro ounces or whatever it is, but there is a weight difference right after you die, from the moment you die to the right after you die. And it's fascinating. And
That's the
they
stuff
don't
that I'm
talk about
like,
that.
okay, let's start paying attention to some of these things, because that means that everything's way, 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 way bigger than what we've been told it is, and that we don't understand half of what we're talking, not even half, way more than half. But I think, like, the thing that was interesting to me about the genes expressing after death is, like, okay, that means that we, that humans have a role that we play in an ecosystem that we never talk about, or that we don't think about, because we have a very human-centric, well, not all of us, but we, most of us have been taught human-centric ways of looking at the world, that, like, we're the center of everything. And then there's all the stuff that's happening that are processes that we're just part of. It's just like, it's freaky, but it's also kind of cool and freeing in a way. They were like, huh, okay, well,
It
I mean, I
is
guess.
another rabbit hole. I've been actually playing in that rabbit hole a lot, and again, that's a whole other podcast. But I think you know, in accepting that you don't know what you know, and accepting that you are not the bearer and the pillar of truth on all things because you don't know what you don't know, I think you know any hope. If, and now that I have permission from my conscience on my shoulder to go and speak back on public forums. I mean, I think it's important that people feel allowed. I think because we've been so silenced, I to feel allowed to go back out there, I think is good.
Oh, I do. I mean, I whatever I've said, I want to make sure that that point gets through. That I don't. I mean, I do think the conversations matter, and I think it just, it does truly go both ways. That if somebody wants to speak, speak, but also be prepared for pushback, because, you know, people have their own opinions about stuff, and so I think that I sometimes get caught up in, like, being afraid of pushback, because I don't. I'm always afraid of hurting people's feelings. I would rather build the relationship more than I would rather express whatever I think. And so I have to think about the times in which, no, this thing does matter. And I was actually having this conversation with somebody online where I'm like, if I choose to say something, I've thought about this thing a lot. And I feel fairly confident in what I am saying. And it's usually been a changed position for me, not a thing that I've thought my whole life, right? Like, it's been a thing that I've looked at and then moved because of new information or something. And I don't feel like it's likely to change again. So those are the three conditions for me to feel pretty certain about saying something. And even then, I'm like, do I really need to? Do I want to? What would it accomplish? But I was trying to explain this to somebody the other day. I was like, the reason I'm not backing down from this conversation is because I thought a lot before I said the first thing.
And the reason that I do back down is because I usually do it on the fly where you've triggered something and I'm like, oh no, you did not say that. And then I feel the need to get in there. But I'm getting better. I'm thinking it through.
Different personality types, right? Like that's
yeah. I think that's why we get along so well, because there is a balance. Like there's a balance of difference of thought, but there's respect. There's respect on both sides of just, I hope you respect me. Respect of you know, a shared idea, you know.
Well, I think too, I mean, look, you wouldn't be doing these types of podcasts if you weren't curious, if you weren't interested in what people have to say. Because you, the way that you interview, the way that you ask questions, is you're not soapboxing. I mean, you have your opinions, but you're not like, let me take up all the air to tell you what I think about everything. And I think again, that's how you tell the difference between the people, whatever opinions are, you can tell the people who are curious about what other people think because they have dialogue and they're willing to go, oh, let me think about that for a minute. I'll come back to you and see what I think. Whereas other people are just like, I just want to talk. And they don't really have room for any kind of change. Like you just sort of tell they're not. Okay, well, I hope eventually you change. I was saying this the other day too. It was like when you said people changing after 10 years or whatever, I was looking back at some stuff from 20 years ago and I was like, how can people have lived 20 years in this world? Specifically in this world. I don't know what it was like when nothing changed. And not have some different opinions than they had 20 years ago. Some, whatever they are. And it was in a conversation with somebody where it was like, I'm having the exact same conversations we had 20 years ago. And I know because I journal stuff. And so and it was like, no, for real, we had that same conversation. But it was just interesting to me. I was like, oh, okay. Like, I don't understand that personality type either. Cause I'm like, tell me more stuff. Like, I love like, tell me the book that you read about that thing. Cause I want to go read it. And you don't have to agree with it, but you're like, oh, I have this, I read this thing and it was interesting. And I don't know what I think about it, but.
Well, let's be clear. Odds are like 50-50 that I might actually even understand any part of it. So, you know.
I mean, I only understand like the tip of the iceberg. I understood the point. I didn't understand the science, if that makes sense. That's me when I read science. I'm like, and what am I supposed to do with that?
Did I get enough of it? That's what I ask at the end of a book. Did I understand enough of it to really go forward? Did I get enough out of it?
There's this book I love. I'm just thinking about book. It's sitting on my bookshelf. It's called The Dawn of Everything. And it's like an archaeologist and anthropologist looking at completely a different perspective on history. Mm-hmm. And there's this whole, you got it.
I got it. My dog ate it a little bit, but I got it and I read it.
That's the other one that I love. But Dawn of Everything, like there's this chapter where they're talking about this excavation of a site. I don't even remember where, right? Like, I don't remember globally where it is. And it goes on about like how many steps there were and how many things there were in this, like, I don't know, inventory, treasury, something. And I'm like, my brain is just going, okay, but what's the point? What did we learn from all the things that you just cataloged? And I know that the archaeology type person would be like, oh, this is so fascinating. There were 17 jars and 2 spoons.
Sounds to me like listening to a guy explain how he fixed his truck. That's really cool. I don't get it, but I get it. But great.
It works. Yeah, that's, and everyone was like, oh, they lived communally and this is the way that their society was. Okay, cool. Like the thing that you concluded from that is what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't sit there and count the spoons personally.
Now I have to read it. Yeah.
Like, it's interesting. It's another one of those books that's just like, huh. Okay, I never thought about it that way. And there are things that there are very clear points where you can be like, nope, I don't agree with that at all. And other points are like, well, maybe I can see their point. And I read there's criticism of what they did too. So it's like, okay, cool.
I mean, it's fun. I just, you know what I really enjoy, and I've always been a book reader. I've always, just because it's something that one takes you away from wherever you are. So you can immerse yourself in a book and learn something completely different. But there's enough in, if you read enough books, you start to figure out who you are. You start to understand what you believe and what you feel to be true. And I think we need to do that more, because I think people need to understand, like, there are other perspectives and you don't have to agree with them, but you can taste them and see what's going on and sample to understand if it fits or if it doesn't fit, and why it doesn't fit helps you understand who you can be.
You basically just said in human normal person speak what the authors of that book say about cultures, and that we know who the cultures know who they are in definition to whatever this next door culture is. And so there's a word they use. I can't remember what word it was, but you tend to see opposites next to each other geographically, because part of what made this culture is that they weren't that culture. We don't do that. That makes us us. That makes them them. And I mean, that's kind of a very oversimplified way of saying it, but we know who we are based on who we are internally, but also who we aren't. You, therefore, I'm me. We have this in common. We have that not in common. The difference is what defines us as unique individuals, versus the commonality is what defines us as part of the same family, the same species, the whatever.
I agree. I think that's the value in it, but I also just enjoy reading any random book I can get a hold of. So, well, I don't want to, I know you and I can talk for hours, so I want to be aware of your time, but we should do this again soon, because I think I want to explore a little bit more of this engagement that you've allowed me, and then see where we go. And I think before the election, we should have another conversation. Just,
I don't know if I should mention this, like, some people have been buying like my books for their teams, because everybody who knows what an election year looks like in digital spaces is ramping up for it, right? But for those of us that want to be able to have conversations and relationships with people, it's about to get real bad.
It's already getting pretty ugly. Yeah.
And so just that alone, deciding what works for you as an individual for how you want to deal with that, specifically the political stuff, the election stuff, the whatever that's going to look like, just making that decision is really helpful. Because it doesn't matter what the decision is. If you want to debate everything, cool, just know that you're going to be on a lot more than you would be if you weren't going to debate.
Be a target.
And if you need to ignore certain things, then that's also okay. Like, but it's going to be a lot more intense than it even has been in the past.
It's terrifying, frankly. But yeah. To that, let's tell people who are driving or whatever where they can find you in the future, and we'll put it all in the show notes, of course. But
Amazon.com. I'm sure people have opinions about that too.
The system works.
And I also have a Substack newsletter that's called Digital Hope. So nice. If people want weekly little thingies.
I call them little hugs.
I need you to do all my PR for me, Wendy.
Happy to. Lauren, you are an amazing human being, and I hope somehow you create a million more amazing people in the world just so we can balance out the crazy. But thank you so much for doing this again, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Thank you so much.